Good morning. I'm a tiny bit loud. I'm a little afraid of speaking. Don't make me that powerful. I'm Eugene. I'm one of the pastors here. And throughout the season of Lent, we're just going to dive right in. Throughout the season of Lent, we've been in this sermon series called Follow Me, or the Radical Way of Jesus. And we've been exploring what it means to follow Jesus, which means to go to the places where Jesus went and to do the things that Jesus did. And where did he go? He went to the poor, the powerless, and the marginalized. And what did he do? He did the work of love, healing, and justice. And Christ's invitation to us today and every day is follow me. Follow me to the oppressed and the disenfranchised. Follow me to love the poor and heal the sick and set the prisoners free. Follow me to the cross where I lay down my life for the sake of love. Follow me. And maybe you never knew that this is what it means to follow Jesus. I did not. For most of my life, most of my Christian life, I was taught it was about making sure I believed the right things and didn't do the bad things. It was about going to church and praying and reading my Bible. And these things are not bad. In fact, they were very important to me, to my growth and formation, up to a point. See, eventually, at a certain point in my life, as I'm growing as a Christian and even in Christian ministry, I realized I had an awakening. And I realized that the person who prayed the most or knew the most about the Bible and theology was not necessarily the most humble, loving, kind, or Christ-like. Depending on your Christian background, it might come as a bit of a shock to hear this, but one can go to church every Sunday and sing songs to Jesus and pray and read the Bible every day and still live in a way that looks nothing like Jesus. Are you tracking with me? There can be a huge difference between being a fan of Jesus and being a follower of Jesus. And here in the U.S. today, since this is our context, there are millions of Bible-believing, church-going Christians who also glorify war and violence and worship wealth and power and are generally, you know, totally cool with racism, sexism, and unjust systems that dehumanize people. What do we do with that? Even more so, there can be a huge difference between those who would use Jesus as a tool for gaining power and those who would follow the way of Jesus and surrender power for the sake of loving others. And today, I feel compelled to be clear and specific about this because it is timely. I'm going to go out a little bit on a limb. There's a movement here in America called Christian nationalism. It's based on the belief that America, if you're unfamiliar with that term, it's based on this idea that America is a God's chosen nation and that the laws of this country should be based on Christianity and the Bible. And that Christians should occupy positions of power in society and in government. And at first, many Christians might think, well, that doesn't sound like such a bad idea. I mean, more of God in society and the world and maybe even in government, that sounds pretty good. The problem is that those who are driving Christian nationalism don't mean Christian as in the universal body of Christ that's full of diversity and includes everybody. What they actually mean is a very particular kind of Christian that happens to align with very conservative white supremacist ideologies. So Christian nationalism is not about Christ. It's about power and control. Not too long ago, a certain presumptive nominee for the Republican Party spoke to a gathering of national religious broadcasters, promising he would restore Christianity's power and prominence in America. He said, and I quote, "If I get in, you're going to be using that power at a level that you've never used before." And just to remind us, when Jesus was tempted in the desert, the devil took him to a very high mountain. He showed him all the kingdoms of the world and all of their splendor. And he said, "All this I will give to you." He said, "If you will bow down and worship me," essentially the devil is saying, "I will give you power and dominion over all of this." But Jesus had a radically different plan in mind, a different way altogether. He would change the world, not through domination and control, but through love and service and sacrifice. Not through violence, but through nonviolence. So as modern Christians, we have to understand that not everything labeled Christian is Christ-like. We need to be discerning and wise. And let me be clear, this is not the way of Jesus. I'm sure you all recognize this photo from January 6th. And some of us might think, of course not. I mean, we're off the hook, right? We would never use Jesus as a tool for our own personal gain, right? We would never make Christianity and following Jesus about our personal success and well-being. Right? Well, if we're being honest, maybe there are some ways that we do. Maybe instead of following the way of Jesus, we really, really want Jesus to follow us. Maybe we want God to follow our agenda, our agendas of comfort and security and success. We want God to grant us our dreams, not be a part of God's dreams. If we're being honest, maybe we even wouldn't mind it if God granted us some power and privilege. Who wouldn't want that? The question we need to wrestle with is, what is the radical way of Jesus? Where is Jesus going? What is Jesus doing? What is Jesus' agenda and dream for the world and for us? And where do we fit into that? Today we're going to look at the familiar story of Jesus walking on water, as it was recorded in the Gospel of John. And I look back and I preached this passage a number of years ago. And the way that I preached it is the way that most people might expect. Maybe you've heard a sermon about this passage before. Jesus is Lord over the wind and the waves, so we don't have to fear the storms of our lives. We can trust God, and God will help us get through the storm. And there's some truth to that. But I've come to see that there's more to the story than Jesus just being a life preserver for us in times of trouble. In a way, it's kind of like making ourselves the main character of the story rather than Jesus. It's something I've been guilty of many times. And so though we're going to be spending most of our time in John's gospel, I'm going to jump around because this miracle is also recorded in the gospels of Matthew and Mark. But actually, Matthew and Mark provide much more detail. For example, in Matthew's account, we learn that Peter actually gets out of the boat and walks on the water with Jesus. Cool, right? I mean, you would figure John would want to include a little detail like that. And one explanation is that many believe, since John's gospel was written much later than the other gospels, the author may have assumed that people were already familiar with this story. And so he includes this miracle in his gospel in a more abbreviated form, without as much detail. And I do this almost every time I preach, as is often the case when we're studying the scriptures. Looking at the surrounding context can give us some very important information about what the author intends to communicate. And in this case, you might notice, if you look up on your, you know, whatever device, not many people carry Bibles anymore, but if you look it up and you look at where this story is placed in the narrative, you might notice that this story of Jesus walking on water happens right after Jesus feeds the 5,000, right? Remember that story? It's a miracle, it's a sign. And so before we go any further, I need to set this up a little bit. It's going to be really helpful to us to point out that there are some clear elements in the story that are intended to remind us of something. It's supposed to remind us of the Exodus. Remember that story? It's the story of God liberating the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And so here are a few clues. First of all, these events happen right around when? The Passover, which is the Jewish holiday that literally commemorates the Exodus. So that's our first clue. And just like God provided manna for the Israelites in the wilderness, Jesus feeds the 5,000 and even calls himself the bread from heaven. And just like Moses and the Israelites passing through the waters to escape the Egyptians, here also we see a passing through the waters by Jesus and the disciples. So keep in mind that the Israelites were escaping captivity and slavery. They were escaping empire. So hold that in your mind. And during this time, right when this is happening, Jesus is gaining in popularity. There were already huge crowds were following him around, and they were just growing bigger. And they were following him around, even going up with him onto a hillside, a mountainside, where he had just performed the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. And there are all these whispers going around about this is it, guys. You know, Jesus is the Messiah. He is the long-awaited Savior who's going to free us from Roman oppression. Just like Moses delivered the Israelites from the Egyptians, this is our moment. And John tells us, after the people saw the sign Jesus performed, this feeding of the 5,000, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who has come into the world. And Jesus does something interesting. Knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, Jesus withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Jesus knows the people wanted to make him their king. They wanted him to lead an uprising. And I don't know about you, but I would not mind it so much if a huge crowd of people wanted to make me their king. Not a bad idea. But instead, Jesus withdraws from the crowds. Imagine being one of the disciples while all this is going on, right? I mean, you're like, this is awesome. We were just regular guys before, right? We're fishermen and, you know, just regular Joes. But now we're in, right? We are the in crowd. Everybody loves us. We are special. We are popular. We are influential. Some of them might be thinking, if Jesus becomes king, maybe I can be vice king. Or a member of his cabinet, or at least a general or something. Imagine if one of your friends became president. Where would your mind go from there? But when evening came, the disciples went down to the lake which is the Sea of Galilee, and they set off across the water on a boat, and it was dark, and Jesus was not with them. And here John skips a pretty important detail here. So we're going to go to the Gospel of Mark. Both Mark and Matthew's accounts tell us that Jesus, quote unquote, made the disciples get into the boat. He made them get into the boat. Jesus uses a strong word here. It was more along the lines of he compelled them to get into the boat. Why? Remember, the crowd wants to make him king. And I think Jesus sees the disciples letting all this get to their heads a little bit. Maybe the disciples are tempted by power and popularity. And seeing this, maybe he said to them, no, you need to go right now. And the disciples may have even objected, but this is going so well, Jesus. They're going to make you king. Maybe Jesus had to force them to get into the boat so that they wouldn't get swept away by all the excitement. And Jesus probably told them he'd meet them on the other side, you know, while he dismissed the crowd, and he was going to go by foot. It's not that far. The Sea of Galilee is about 5 miles across. He would have maybe taken a while, but he could have gone around by foot. The Sea of Galilee was known to have these sudden storms that would seemingly pop up out of nowhere. And of course, one of these storms happened to hit right when the disciples are trying to cross. And so you can imagine that they've been rowing for hours with this strong headwind, but they only managed to travel a few miles. And so they were still far from the shore. They're exhausted. They're fearing for their lives. They've been rowing for hours, and their backs are against the wind as they're trying to row. When suddenly, off in the distance, they see something coming toward them on the water. Like already, that's enough to freak anybody out. But they see a figure that looks like a human approaching them, moving against the wind. And guess what? It's catching up. So, of course, they're freaking out. I mean, this is sort of like, it sounds like a horror movie, right? And they might have tried to row faster to get away from whatever the heck that thing is, but the figure keeps closing in on them. And Mark tells us the disciples thought it was a ghost. Of course, I mean, what else could it be? And Mark also gives us another interesting detail, and this part's kind of, I mean, I find this humorous. He says, Jesus was walking on the lake and was about to pass them. Just picture this, right? The disciples are rowing with all their might while Jesus is walking toward them on the water, and he's about to pass by. And that is until the disciples, like, they're crying out in terror. And maybe Jesus didn't think this was a big deal. I mean, we know from another incident when Jesus is sleeping through the middle of a storm, that he is not afraid of storms. Maybe Jesus didn't even intend to come aboard at all. He was just going to walk the rest of the way across the water, meet them on the other side, be like, hey guys, what took you so long? So the disciples are rightly terrified, but Jesus says to them, it is I. Don't be afraid. He says, it is I. When he says this, he's saying more than just, hey, it's me. A literal reading from the Greek could be translated as, I am. I am. As in the name God gave to Moses to reveal himself. I am who I am, which, coincidentally or not, also comes straight out of the Exodus story. In other words, Jesus is saying, I am is here. I am God. Don't be afraid. And I'm walking on water, a not so subtle clue that this is no ordinary human. Jesus says, don't be afraid. The I am is here. You don't have to be afraid anymore. And then Jesus got in the boat. The wind stopped and they reached the shore. And Matthew tells us the disciples then worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. So, this is a story about the disciples being in trouble and then Jesus coming to save them, right? Cool trick, right? Yes. But it is also a sign that points to something bigger. Why does John include this miracle here? And why does Jesus even bother with this at all? Right? Why not just send your friends across the lake and command the water to be calm in the first place so that your buddies can get across safely? See, this sign, this miracle was clearly meant for the disciples. Jesus had a purpose. Nobody else was there. And I believe Jesus did this intentionally to help the disciples understand something very important, and it's something for us to understand today as well. And the key to understanding this is what happens after they reach the shore. Right? They cross the lake, they reach the shore, and then what happens? The crowds find Jesus on the other side of the lake. And essentially, they ask for another miracle, because miracles are cool. Right? And they're asking specifically for a miracle in the form of more food, because remember, he just fed them, you know, this wonderful meal. And so Jesus replies enigmatically, I am, there's that word again, the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never go thirsty. And at this, the Jews started to grumble about him, like, what? What is he talking about? I mean, I can imagine the disciples starting to feel nervous, like, oh, Jesus, what are you doing? Knock it off. He didn't really mean that, you know. But Jesus doesn't knock it off. Instead, he continues. He says, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Then the Jews began to argue sharply among themselves. Okay, what now? How can this man give us his flesh to eat? But Jesus doesn't stop there. He says, very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. So to a Jew at this time, they would have been like, blah, right? I mean, that did it. It's done. Essentially, Jesus told the crowds, hey, eat me. And on hearing it, many of his disciples said, this is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? And from this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. And the disciples must have been dumbfounded. Like, what just happened? Everything was going so well. Jesus, they were going to make you king, and you ruined it all. See, this was a turning point in Jesus' ministry. Up until this point, Jesus' popularity was growing and growing, and in an instant, canceled. All that changed. And from this moment on, the people would begin to be divided about who Jesus is. Following Jesus is about to get a lot less fun for the disciples, and gradually more and more difficult. Jesus' approval ratings are about to take a huge drop, and they're going to just keep dropping lower and lower. And even the religious leaders would begin plotting to kill Jesus. Up until this point, it's been pretty smooth sailing. But the seas are just about to get rough. And that is why I believe the story of Jesus walking on the water matters. Matters to the disciples, and it matters to us. You see, Jesus knew what he needed to do. He did not come to be king. He came to be a servant. He did not come to gain power. He came to lay it down. He came to suffer and die so that we and the whole world might be healed and reconciled to God. See, Jesus knew he was going to the cross, which means following him was going to become very confusing and terrifying. And so at this critical juncture, Jesus walks on the water to demonstrate to his disciples who he was. Jesus is the I Am. They don't need to be afraid, and neither do we. And it seemed to have worked. After all this happens, as everyone else was leaving Jesus, they're abandoning ship, Jesus asked the 12, "You do not want to leave too, do you?" To which Simon Peter replied, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God." So what is all this about? Okay, spoiler alert. It's not about us. When we look at all of these events together, we might start to see a bigger picture of what Jesus is doing. We are not the main character of this story. Jesus is the new Moses, delivering his people out of empire, out of subjugation, out from under domination, and into freedom. And the problem I alluded to earlier in this sermon is that many Christians today want to be the empire. Instead of leaving Egypt, we want to be Egypt. Rather than be a liberated people, inviting others into this radical way of Jesus. They'd rather subjugate others. They want to be in control and dominate. And this is the very thing Jesus came to deliver us out of. History teaches us that the more Christianity becomes commingled with power, the less and less it looks like Jesus. A Christianity that is based on competition and conquest can never heal the world. It will only make things worse. The only thing that can heal the world is a Christianity based on love and liberation. Following Jesus is not about popularity, power, or privilege. Jesus makes that very clear from his example. Jesus has a different agenda, to lay down his life. Jesus did not walk on water to assure the disciples that everything was going to go their way, that they're going to be popular, powerful, and privileged. It was to assure them that if they continue to follow him, things are probably not going to go the way they expected or hoped. But they don't have to be afraid, because I Am is with them. Jesus did not walk on water so that we would know everything is going to work out perfectly for us. I've preached that sermon before, and there's some truth to that. But Jesus, I believe, walked on water so that we would have the courage to do hard things. Let me say it again. Jesus walked on water so that we would have the courage to do hard and costly things. not to have our own way, not to baptize and bless our plans and our ambitions. Following Jesus means facing danger with courage, uncertainty with hope and confidence. Following Jesus is not about hiding and living in fear and never taking risks. It's about walking in radical obedience to God and trusting God enough to follow Jesus, the way of Jesus, meaning to love and serve sacrificially and to stand in solidarity with the poor and the powerless. So following Jesus is not about all smooth sailing. If we're being faithful to Jesus, if we're following Jesus, going to the places Jesus went and doing the things Jesus did, then it will inevitably lead us into some stormy waters. Some of you might be aware that I used to be one of the pastors at another church here in the area. And I was at this church for over 17 years. And I was there in very early years. I was a part of helping to grow this church from a small startup into a pretty large established church in our area and with multiple locations. And in many people's eyes, we were winning. We were popular. We were influential. Our church was literally on the cover of our denominational magazine multiple times. And to be honest, I enjoyed a position of considerable power and privilege. In many ways, as a pastor, I was living the dream. I know many people and even friends who would have done anything to be in my place. I mean, not only were things going really well, I mean, I loved my church. And I loved my community. And this is a longer story, but in 2020, it became clear that I needed to step down and leave this behind. And one of the reasons why is that I've always had this heart for the people on the outside, a heart for the people who are never going to walk through the doors of our church, right? People on the outside who are longing for genuine spiritual community, but for any number of reasons, just did not fit so well in a traditional Sunday church. And so that led me to the current work, my other job I'm doing, creating alternative ways for people to gather. Things in my church were going great, but it was kind of like God saying, you need to go. It was like rowing my boat out into a stormy sea, you know, leaving behind the people I loved and everything I was familiar with. And all this was really difficult and costly. I knew very little about what I would actually do and how I would do it. I had a very stable income before, and now I had to figure out how I would provide for my family, and it was scary. But I felt compelled that this is where Jesus was inviting me to follow him, to the margins. I love my church, but I felt called to the people for whom institutional church just didn't make sense anymore, to the people who've been hurt or harmed by the church, to the people who have been burnt out or left out. But this is not about me going out to save people like I'm the hero. Going to those outside the church, to the margins, is where I found Jesus already at work, walking on waves. And Jesus is at work here, too, in this congregation. And I think about this often. There is so much potential right here in this room. But some of us have been playing it too safe for too long. Maybe we've steered clear of any clouds that might even look a little threatening to our comfort and security. Maybe our dreams are too small. Maybe we've bought into the American dream with some Jesus as an add-on accessory. Maybe some of us are just not doing much in the world other than showing up to church on Sunday. And I have to wonder, maybe this is why so many of us feel like we're lacking purpose and meaning and direction in life. We've settled for being Jesus fans when Jesus invites us to be his radical followers. Maybe you've been hesitant to take a specific step of obedience because you've been afraid of what it might cost you. Maybe there are some areas of your life where you simply aren't following the way of Jesus. Maybe it's your finances or your relationships or your work. Any of these can feel like scary places to follow Jesus into. Maybe we're afraid of letting go of control over our money or our position or our reputation. Maybe we're afraid to take a stand and use our voice on behalf of the marginalized. Maybe we're afraid of what people might think of us. What does it mean to follow Jesus into the storm so that Jesus can meet us there? Or rather, we can meet Jesus where he's already at work. I want to invite you to spend the next few minutes sitting with those questions and bringing them to God. And I always feel like when we're praying, we should activate more than just our minds. If you would, and you feel comfortable doing so, would you just open your palms up in a posture of openness and surrender? How might Jesus be calling you to follow him? What does that look like? Who will you serve and sacrifice for? Who will you stand up for? Who will you protect? How will you use your time and talents and treasure to join in what God is already doing in the world? I invite you to sit and listen and be open to the Holy Spirit, and we'll continue in our response and worship.